I'm Monica Taylor, former editor of the Journal of Moral Education, and I'm extremely pleased today to welcome to this series of conversations my esteemed friend and colleague, Professor Emerita Mal Lester. We've known each other, Mal, haven't we, since the early 1980s?
An amazing amount of time.
Yes, this is now about 45 years. And during that time, we've not only been personally friendly, really from the get-go, I think, but also we've had some close working relationships on the Journal of Moral Education. Other associations we've been involved with, and in co-editing a collection and a couple of special issues you were involved with, so on. So there's a lot of ground that we have to try and distill for this.
Yes, indeed.
I wanted to begin, Mal, because we have to begin somewhere. With your early life, and this is the point where I always learn more about people, even people like yourself, whom I've known quite well for many years. I think you're 2 or 3 years older than me, so you were born just after the end of the war, I think, and you.
That's about 1946.
Yes, that's what I thought. And you had you're the first in a family of three. Your family, I think, if I remember rightly, was very embedded in an extended family. And you lived in Manchester on Moss Side, is that correct?
No, well, my first 2 years I was in Moss Side at
Right.
my grandmother's house, but then my parents moved to got a council house in a big council estate, Wythenshawe, which is on the outskirts of Manchester. So I was born to a working class family, and as you say, both my parents came from big families, so it was a very extensive, wider family, and all very close. And I think that gave me a lot of security, actually, because you were part of a tribe, our Mal, And also, I was the first in the family and the first from my school to go to university. So that was an experience of achieving something at quite a young age, really. And at university, I did an honours degree in English and philosophy. And I found I just loved philosophy, and that's
Yes.
ever since.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask you that, but may I ask you just a little bit more about your family, because they come in later on, I think, in our conversation with regard to support with your daughter. So I had the privilege of meeting your father, but never your mother, and you had two younger brothers who are twins.
Did, yes.
So in some ways you must have been in a caring role for them, I guess.
Well, certainly, I mean, I can trace back enjoying writing stories to the fact that I used to make up stories for my twin brothers, and they loved them. And we had a long bus journey to one of my aunties on a Sunday evening, and I used to keep them occupied with these stories.
You say that came naturally to you, Mal.
It came naturally. And my parents were very decent and intelligent and moral and politically aware people. Although I've not lived in two cultures in the sense of that people usually think of that, I have lived with the working class and the middle class, and
Yes.
I have experienced the kind of assumptions, the wrongful assumptions that middle class people often make about working class families.
Yes, would you like to say something about that?
Well, I don't know that there's much more to say than that, really, Monica. But I always identified with the working class more than the middle class and the underdog and that sort of thing.
Yes.
My parents were such good people. And as you say later, when I had the great sadness and trauma of Jane having a brain tumour at 18 months old and then subsequent, problems, serious disabilities and so on, they were just so good, so supportive.
Yes. Yes. So all of that was part of the ethos of what you grew up with, and with your aunts and uncles around and cousins. I think some of your cousins also did very well and achieved academically.
They did. They did. They became my father's brother had four daughters and three of them who followed me from the same school.
Yes.
So they said we did well for that school, Mal. But they became GPs.
Yes. What do you think there was anything at that school that helped you?
No. Otherwise, why were we the only ones?
Well, this is a point.
I think that came from our families more than from the school.
Yeah. Well, you went from school, as you mentioned, to university in Aberystwyth, University of Wales.
Yes.
That was at about the usual sort of time. You were about 17 or 18, I think.
Yes.
And you read a joint degree, English and Philosophy. That wasn't quite so common then, was it? And as you know, I read philosophy, though there was a point at which I might have combined them, English and philosophy. So
yes.
we had that common interest also. I know how I became interested in philosophy, but how did you?
Well, I didn't realise, but when I read, before I went to university, I read The Brothers Karamazov. There's an extract in that where one brother says to the other, describes this landowner setting his dogs on a child in front of the mother's eyes and it's ripped to pieces. And he says, would you, for any conceivable reason, create a world in which that could happen? And of course, it's the problem of evil, the philosophical problem of evil. How can an all-powerful and all-good God have created such a world with such suffering, including suffering of the innocent? And I wrote a whole, this got me going, and I wrote a whole exercise book about this. And I didn't know then that what I was doing was philosophy. When I went to university and found out what philosophy was, I realised that it had been, actually. And I just loved it in university, and ever after, really.
And you loved the actual business of thinking.
Yes, the abstract nature, the concern with ideas and concepts. I just found it all fascinating.
It's curious. I didn't know about your interest in the Brothers Karamazov, because my favourite book as an adolescent was Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment.
Really?
And I couldn't...
I didn't know that either.
No, and I couldn't put that down. I was absolutely glued to it. And that too raises some very profound philosophical questions about life and death and, you know, how you behave towards people and so on. So I guess we were both that's interesting to know that we were both influenced by those books, Russian literature. I used to read quite a bit of Russian literature at the time. So you really embraced philosophy, I think reflecting on your abilities and my working with you and so on, I think you found it much more to your taste or liking, or you were better at it than me. I always struggled a bit. Whereas for me, you always seemed very clear-headed about concepts and ideas and their interrelationship.
Yes, well, and of course, subsequently, a lot of my publications have been philosophical, analysing concepts such as equal opportunities
Yes.
in relation to anti-racist multicultural education. So I feel that one of my contributions has been sort of philosophical aspects of particularly to do with ethnicity, but also disability.
Yes, absolutely. And I was reminded today, looking at some materials you sent to me and your CV and so on, because of all your qualifications. So you did, after your BA, was a BA, wasn't it, in
Yes.
Christian philosophy. After that, you did an M.Ed about the justification for religious education. I completely overlooked that.
Yes.
And then, so because time's going on during, your life and your teaching and so on, you did your PhD, metaphysics and multicultural education, because that links up with what you were just talking about, your interest. You submitted that in 1984, and I had a little memory that I was one of your examiners, because by then we did know each other, and I came up to Manchester for the day.
Yes, in fact, I had three examiners.
Yes.
I don't quite know why, how that all came about, but anyway.
Yes, and your supervisor was John Harris. Harris.
He stepped in because my first supervisor was just not there at all,
Oh,
really.
yes. I think there was quite a bit of that went on in those days. So, you've got several qualifications, and this was alongside your working, and you had a daughter. So I'm thinking this was quite tough, or could have been quite tough, right? Because in the late 60s, early 70s, it wasn't easy to be a woman and have a child and work.
Yes, again, I was lucky, you see, in my family being there. You know, if I wanted to go to a conference, they were there to look after Jane. Writing came very naturally to me, so I didn't find that a big sweat like a lot of, well, like some academics do. And
Yes.
also, because it was usually philosophical ideas, I didn't have to have done a whole mound of empirical work,
Ah, that's true. Yes. Yeah.
which is less time consuming, therefore.
Well, it can be done by thinking, getting clearer, writing, getting clearer again, and so on. It doesn't require going out in the field or talking to a lot of people and analyzing data and so on.
Yes.
You did a bit of that later, but mostly you didn't. Yes. So it cut down on the, perhaps it cut down on the time input. But I think what was important to me when I was reading your CV was, seemed to me that your experiences in your early years post graduation, when you were also getting these additional academic qualifications, you were a secondary school teacher. for some years in Manchester, a few years, and then you went to a college, Fieldon Park, a college in Manchester, and then to Bolton College, and continued as a lecturer in philosophy of education and multicultural studies at Bolton College. So for about 10 years, you were doing all that, what we might call groundwork, right? Actual teaching with real students in school and college.
Yes, and there were multicultural schools where I taught. And then I went to a, I don't know whether you know this, Monica, but there was a strike called Grunwick, where Asian women were protesting about not being allowed to join a union. And it became a very big thing, and I went along to join the protest. And we were herded into a cul-de-sac, and the police came at us with truncheons and feet, boots. And that was such a big experience, such a shock, really, that I thought I want to do something political now. And that's when I found my place at working for AFOR, a community anti-racist organisation in Handsworth, Birmingham. I became the education worker and subsequently the director. And it was the kind of place where you learn things that you can't learn from books, you know, and
Absolutely.
a commitment as well, a very strong commitment, an anti-racist commitment. So that, and then from there, I became the head of a centre for multicultural education, which was a big job because I had 60 teachers under me, and they went out into schools doing English as a second language and developing a multicultural curriculum. And I have to say, Monica, one of the things I am proud of, and I include you in this because you did it as well, I think we were part of that movement of establishing multicultural education in British schools. And that was important.
Well, it would be nice to think that. Certainly, I think we could say we contributed to the debate, discussion, information input on that those topics because they were new. It's not like now where they're going round again for several iterations. They were absolutely new. That was the first time people were really engaged with talking about them.
Absolutely. In fact, going right back to when I worked for AFOR, I did a collection of stories that had a black princess and a black fairy and black children. And it was so new that I was invited on to Woman's Hour to talk about it. And again, that was spreading that message, and gradually materials in schools did come to incorporate black children and so on, because
Yeah.
they were completely absent at one time.
Well, it was, it also became tokenistic, didn't it, before it became much more integral.
It was. And then a little later, I realised the same thing was true about disabled children. And
Yes.
so I wrote a book, Special Stories for Disability Awareness, and that was shortlisted by the Times Higher Education Supplement. And we went and sat round tables, you know, rather like a sort of a poor man's Booker Prize. And we didn't win, but we all were given a certificate. And Jane, my daughter, she'd done a chapter in that book, Growing Up with a Disability.
Yes.
And she was given a certificate as well, of course, quite rightly, but she was so pleased. It was lovely.
Yes. Would you like to say more now about your work with disability? Because we agreed before this meeting that there are several areas, themes that cover your important, most important aspects of your your contribution and equal opportunities through disability awareness is definitely one of them, isn't it?
Yes. It was obviously that commitment was deepened by Jane having this brain tumor, which left her with serious disabilities.
Yes.
So that gave one an awareness from a personal level. And for example, all that, I was aware being drawn into moral education, and thank you, Monica, because that was you drawing me into the JME world. I became aware how much emphasis was given to Kohlberg and his moral stages, which involved reasoning and so on. Well, Jane couldn't reason at an abstract level, but she was one of the most moral people I've ever known, because if she knew something was right, she did it. If she thought something was wrong, she didn't do it. And what she used was her great empathy and sympathy, and therefore kindness.
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, that's all part of being a moral person. It's not just reasoning,
Absolutely.
it's kind of empathy and feeling.
Well, as you know, I agree because in our collection, we're moving about as I expected we would in this conversation. One thing's leading to another thing because they're not separate. I mean, that's an important thing to say. As you know, I also thought that you could learn about other concepts through empathy because that paper I contributed to our edited collection, Ethics, Ethnicity and Education, was about learning fairness through empathy. And I used empirical work from the pupils on their perspectives about
Yes.
putting policy into practice. So, I think, that's all still worth emphasizing, but that it isn't necessarily a stage-related reasoning development across the some kind of learning cycle. Is it doesn't, it's not linear, it's not age-related, it's not necessarily reasoning development, is it? There are other ways of learning and being.
Yes, and that interrelation of the personal and the professional and the academic and so on, that's true to life, because we're not one day an academic and the next day a mother and the next day a friend. They're all interrelated. And you actually edited an issue of the journal where you asked contributors, of whom I was one, to interrelate our professional and our personal
Yes.
when thinking about moral education. And I thought that was a really good idea.
That was my swan song. That was my retirement specialist you as editor of the Journal of Moral Education in 2011.
Thank
And
you.
I asked people to write about their integration of the personal, professional, and political. And you embraced the task. Wrote a paper about triadic moral learning and disability awareness. And you found that very easy because you've got it all to hand in experience and your thinking. Whereas some people found that extraordinarily difficult. And I had to do a certain amount of hand holding with some people I would never have expected to have found it so difficult.
Yes, interesting.
Because they perhaps, separated off those different areas of their lives. It wasn't that they weren't engaged, it was that they didn't necessarily leak from one area of their lives to another.
No.
Whereas I knew in your case, it was all well integrated. I have a book here, which, because you kindly over the years gave me some copies of your books. The one I've got here about disability is called Disability Voice, Towards an Enabling Education. And that book did draw on some empirical interviews that you did with, I think you did with parents, and a colleague of yours did them with, I'm not sure if they were with students or some,
Professor Lovell.
yes, with policymakers. And this followed in the wake of the Warnock report, which was a very important report in the UK
Yes, it was.
about integrating what was then called disabled children rather than children with disabilities. We have had some changes in the language, fortunately, into mainstream schools. And you were looking at some of those equal opportunities issues. But you included in that the voices and views of people with disabilities themselves.
Yes, well, I had a research associate, Tessa Lovell, so she'd done a lot of empirical work. So again, it saved me the
Yes,
time.
but you worked with her, and the important thing there, I think, is that you brought to it the usual conceptual clarity and so on, but that you were also bringing to bear on these issues what people with various disabilities themselves had to say, and listening to their arguments. Right, rather than, I don't think people fully understood that, did they? They were inclined, people with experience were inclined to speak for people with disabilities rather than to hear their own views and stories.
Well, yes, it's part of the stereotyping and prejudice, isn't it, that's so prevalent about.
I think we might come back to some of these issues towards the end of our conversation, Mal. And I'm just wondering if, as we've mentioned several times the journal and so on, if I would just say how we came to know each other, which I've traced back to our initial correspondence, which started in 1981 when you sent me as editor of the journal a paper about moral education and multiracial education.
You accepted the paper, Monica, but you did describe it as a modest paper.
I did. It says here, I've got my reply to you, and I'm slightly embarrassed to read this out. The editorial board, and I always use the editorial board as a cover, right? I mean, of course, it had been peer reviewed, but it at that point in my editorship, I suppose, 5 or 6 years down the line, I kind of felt still I needed a bit of backup, and I said it had been considered in full, your paper, moral education, education of emotions, multicultural education, their interconnection. You see, that's another thing. You've always been interested in crossing boundaries and looking at the interconnections, came out in that title. And I found it, quotes, a modest and interesting paper. Yeah. And then I asked you to write, to develop the multiracial implications a bit in a few more paragraphs. And then I mentioned, because you'd included some information about AFOL, and I told you about the work I was doing for the Swan Committee of Inquiry into the Education of Ethnic Minority Pupils, which, as you know, preoccupied me for a few years. And that's how we first connected, and we first had a lot of conversations about multicultural anti-racist education, which, as you've mentioned, you were deeply engaged with from a community perspective at All Faiths for One Race in Birmingham. But also, then you took on this very onerous and responsible position as advisor in multicultural education for Avon, a large county in the west of England. with a lot of day-to-day admin, as well as, a leadership role. So that was, looking at your CV, one could see how this evolved, Mal. And these seem, in retrospect, to me, looking at your CV, a kind of natural journey and pathway. But also, I guess that change from Afor to Avon was quite a big leap in a way.
Yes, it was. And I didn't, and I enjoyed being at the head of the centre, but when I became an advisor, I didn't find that so congenial, because you had to be very diplomatic. And that's not me, really. But so I was glad to go from there to Warwick University, which was my first university post.
Yes,
I must say it felt like coming home, being in university.
it did.
Sometimes, somewhere in all of that, I became the I became you invited me onto the board of the journal.
Yes, I wanted to say a bit about that because that happened quite early on in after our first encounters. So you were on the floor of the journal for from 1984 to 2009, a period of 25 years.
Long time. And I really appreciated that. I enjoyed my connection with you and with the journal and other people on the journal. You and I and Peter Tomlinson, the late Peter Tomlinson, used to meet for an hour before the JME meetings proper, and we had such interesting and lively discussions.
Yes.
Indeed, if Peter was still around, I'm sure he would be one of the people you would be interviewing.
Absolutely. It's a sadness to me that I wasn't able to talk with him before he passed away last year. But as you know, I've written an obituary for him, which is now published in the JME. And I hope people will realise how significant he was to the JME. He was your predecessor. As a book review editor, you became book review editor in 1990 for 9 years. And so, although before that you and I were well aware of each other's work and our lifestyles, and we overlapped quite a bit in various things, meeting at Mosaic occasionally, for example. And but it was after you became book review editor that we started to work more closely together because there were a certain number of tasks which had to be done every few weeks to produce reviews and get them published in 4 issues of the journal a year. So we would always have discussions, wouldn't we, after you'd done some preliminary sifting of the books that came
Yes.
in. And you were also very keen on curriculum materials.
Yes, I introduced a section, didn't I, on curriculum materials.
Yeah. And see, that was, I think that was also a reflection of your grounding in actual teaching, unlike myself. So, you were very aware of the fact that people would welcome some help, and you had an idea as to how, which kinds of publications could be helpful and which were worth their precious time, precious and limited time.
Yes.
So
Also, in all of that, we woven into all of that, we used to go to quite a lot of international conferences, and meet up with each other and other people, and I was very glad of that because it helped me to develop international contacts and international perspectives.
Yes. Well, I
So.
think we went to, there was one, I noticed when I was thinking about it today, there was a period around 1990 and into the early 90s that we did quite a bit of that. For example, we went to the Association for Moral Education in North America, and we did a symposium with Dwight Boyd. Do you remember? Moral education in a pluralist society. Can it be done? Can it be moral?
Yes.
And we each gave presentations from our current work. And
Yes.
I think that was quite different in a way, because that was, if you like, one of the earlier works, not the earliest, because perhaps the earliest in relation to the JME was your special issue, of which you were a guest editor in 1986, so a few years earlier, on race, culture, and moral education. And you wrote the editorial, and you had some contacts, people who wrote different themes. I did a little review of the ethical dimensions of the Swan Report.
Yes.
And so that, from the beginning of our friendship and professional relationship, we were very interested in those connections between multicultural anti-racist education and moral education and development. And I think we can say that other people on the whole, with perhaps one or two honourable exceptions, were not interested in that connection.
No, and it was something we strongly had in common, wasn't it? A lot
Was.
of philosophical aspects of all this.
And it was very clear to us, but I remember you being much clearer about it. I, as usual, was a bit fuzzier about it, but I remember a particular discussion we had over my dining room table once in Cookham, about how we were going to write the editorial for our edited collection, Ethics, Ethnicity and Education, which came out in 1982, and which I think is still, it may still be in publication. And we were very clear that discrimination on grounds of ethnicity, not only race, but grounds of ethnicity, i.e. culture, religion, values, was a moral issue. And we said so very clearly. I haven't got the words next to me, but it, I don't know. I will never know. Perhaps we can't know whether other people just assumed that, or whether they didn't see the connection, because they certainly weren't making it explicit.
No, it would have been omitted if we hadn't put it there, I think,
Yes.
in many cases. And to me, it very clearly is an aspect of moral education.
Absolutely. Central to it. And people will now be, doing work assuming that, right? It's moved on in different directions. But I think one of the important things we did by doing that collection was to make that very explicit, so people couldn't ignore that connection.
Yes, and some very good papers in there.
There are. And I remember we struggled with one or two of them, and getting people to write the papers, getting them out of them, like our dear friend Terry McLaughlin, who did produce a paper, The Ethics of Separate Schools, wasn't always easy.
No.
And what we brought to that, I think, was that we knew people in the fields of multicultural anti-racist education, which you were working in, and me at a distance, doing research, and we knew the people in moral education. So we asked people from both backgrounds, and we asked them to think about the implication of one for the other. And true to form, people had great difficulty with that. The people hadn't necessarily thought about it. So
I mean,
they.
Terry McLaughlin produced wonderful work, but it was very difficult getting it out of him, wasn't it?
Yes. And people who could write about anti-racist education didn't necessarily know how to develop the moral implications or the moral aspects, and vice versa. And that's always been a problem with the JME, you know, that people have sometimes written clearly about conceptual issues or even to some extent empirical issues, but without drawing out the implications for moral education and development. And I was constantly having to ask people to tack something on. But I think we tackled that head on, really. We saw that as integral, whereas people didn't.
Yes. Perhaps I should say as well, you know, because we were going through my CV, as it were, that after Warwick, I went to Nottingham University as Professor of Adult Learning and Teaching. So that another aspect of my work has been lifelong learning,
Absolutely.
post-school education, that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely.
So the moral education, you know, dimension of that.
Indeed. And you also, so in a way, I think that came again from your experience of working with adults in the field at various levels, but it seemed to crystallize when you got more to Warwick University, because you were a lecturer and then senior lecturer in continuing education, weren't you? And you did I think another very interesting and influential collection with your colleague John Field, called Lifelong Learning.
Yes.
That was published in about 2000. And I was looking at that again, and you had some quite well-known people in that collection too.
Yes. Yeah, we did how it gets some good people, good
Yeah.
papers.
And again, I think you tackled it from various dimensions. So there was a theoretical section, in which you contributed a paper with Jack Cohen about brain science and that the implications for
Yes.
lifelong education. And then there was also a curriculum section, school and beyond, and some interesting international perspectives from South Africa, China, Australia, North America, Europe, and then you also dealt with some contemporary issues, and there it linked with, once again, with disability and race, even the Third Age, and so on. So I think that was another very wide-ranging book which drew on a lot of your and John Field's contacts in the field.
Yes. And also you reminded me that I did a special issue for the journal
You
on
did.
lifelong learning and moral education, because again, it's I don't know if it's, I'm not quite sure whether it's still the case because I'm a little bit out of touch, but it was a relatively neglected area of
Absolutely.
learning or post-school education to think of moral education.
It was. You did that in 1998. And that was because, you know, we were always looking for special issues to deal with relatively unexplored topics. And that definitely fitted that bill. Again, it encountered the issue that I mentioned with regard to ethnicity and race and moral education. there were two camps in a way. There were the people who'd done work in moral development, the people who'd done work in lifelong education, but they didn't necessarily see it from the other perspective.
Yes, they didn't overlap or connect.
No.
Yes.
So,
Yes.
and there's a contribution in that from our another dear friend who sadly passed away some years ago, like Terry, and that was Tom Kitwood. He did a paper on professional and moral development for care work.
Yes.
So, I think by using the journal for special issues, book reviews, and your unstinting time with being a referee, we were, even through the journal, trying to push things on a bit, cross some boundaries, make new contribution to the standard fare in moral education and development, which, as you mentioned earlier, was heavily dominated by Kohlbergian stage theory. So you were trying to introduce some new content and some new perspectives for people to think about, which is really important. The another area of your interest, I mean, I should perhaps say up front that because you may be too modest to do so, you have published about 12 books, about 30 papers in peer-reviewed journals, and 20 chapters in books, and so on. And we'll come to the other things that you've done. I'm not diminishing them. I just want to focus perhaps on them in your post employment. I'm not calling it post retirement because neither of us are probably retired. Your post employment years, right? I noticed that your papers in peer reviewed journals were published in a whole range of journals, and I'm just going to mention them because I think this illustrates the breadth and diversity of your interests and competence. Journal of Philosophy of Education, the JME, the British Journal of Religious Education, Education Journal, New Community, a very a multicultural anti-racist journal, right? Pastoral Care, Studies in Education of Adults, Multicultural Teaching, Disability and Society. That, I think, gives, in a nutshell, the full range, or most of the range, of your interests, because they are all peer-reviewed journals. They're not, they're not just small publications. They've got serious standards.
Yes, that was a wide range. But those interests also had interconnections, you know.
Yes.
So then there was the adult ed journals, like the International Journal for Adult Education, and as you said, the disability ones, and the Philosophy of Education Society journal.
Yes. And were you much involved in the PESGB? I mean, I was involved in the early 70s, so that was before we knew each other. But I wasn't really greatly involved, although I went to some seminars after that for one reason or another. And I was not sure the extent of your involvement with that.
Well, I did go to a fair few seminars in London, and also to the Oxford annual conference,
Yes.
which I always greatly enjoyed.
I think you might have been more faithful to that than I was.
Well, you had a lot on your plate with the journal anyway, didn't you?
Well, that's true, but you made space for it because I think you saw it as much more fundamental to your interests.
And it kept me on my toes because there were some very good people and very good papers at those annual conferences in Oxford.
One of the things, so we've established, perhaps your main areas of interest, except for fiction and educational materials, which I want to come on to in a bit. But do you? I do remember you being very clear about cultural discrimination. And how important that was. And I think if I remember correctly, you argued once that you thought, in some respects, and I may have got this wrong, so don't hesitate to correct me, in some respects, you thought that might be as significant as racial discrimination.
Well, I can't remember exactly what I might have said, but certainly both are very, very important, aren't they? Discrimination and prejudice based and stereotypes and so on, based on race, based on skin colour, is very damaging, and so is discrimination based on culture and cultural difference.
Yes. And of course, it seems to me, well, I say of course, it seems to me, looking at, shall we say, the main themes of your interest, equal opportunities, especially in relation to ethnicity and disability, multicultural education, philosophical aspects of moral education, lifelong learning, all those things are, in a way, unfortunately, very much Cinderella areas and areas, controversial areas, that they all involve controversies, disagreements.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Cinderella areas and controversial areas.
And this may be a bit of a difficult question, but you've obviously been very interested, as you said, from an early age in philosophical questions, concepts, ideas, reasoning, argument in the true sense, and so on. Do you think there is any in your own interest in those themes that you identified, and I readily agreed with, do you think there was any kind of philosophical underpinning to your interest in those?
Underpinning to what? Sorry, Monica.
Well, your themes of work, your long-term aspects of your work in equal opportunities, disability, race, multicultural education, lifelong learning, and so on. Do you think there was a common philosophical concern underpinning?
Yes, I do. I think a number of things actually. I think the philosophical commitment to clarity and the philosophical interest in abstract ideas come underpins all of those areas, as do certain values underpin all of those areas. So yeah, there is a commonality. You're absolutely right.
Have you ever written anything about that?
I don't think so. I've sometimes drawn on one area to illuminate another. So I remember doing a paper where all the things that we'd all been saying, from the Swan Report onward, really, and about prejudice and institutional racism in
Yes.
the ethnicity. I did apply all of that to disability, and that I think was quite illuminating. And I think because although there are significant differences, there are also commonalities
Yes.
experience of minorities and oppressed groups and so on.
Yes, that's what I've written in my notes. Overlaps, commonalities, and differences. Yeah. And I mean, it would be very interesting from perspective of hindsight if ever you felt like writing something about that, because I don't think many people would have your breadth of interest or application to that range of Cinderella issues. Cinderella, very challenging, incredibly important issue.
That's an idea.
We had another idea deep recently. Well, we've had it for a while, but we still have yet to act on it, about ageism and moral education, since we're now approaching our eighth decade. It was curious when I was looking through the history of the JME that I wrote in about 2012, and which I keep meaning to update, that I came completely serendipitously on a quote from the first JME editor, Derek Wright, who you will remember, I think, possibly Mal, because he was still on the board, I think, when you started. He was professor of psychology at Leicester, and he had written about in this was in 1976, that the journal had yet to publish